podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
It is the Anfield Wrap. After Liverpool beat Southampton by 3-1, I've got Jake Nolan, Dan Austin and Paul Senior to talk about that, focusing on the goalkeeper, Darwin Nunez, the midfield, because we've talked about it a lot, the bigger picture in terms of top four, and then the even bigger picture around stories of Liverpool's potential sale by Fenway Sports Group. That is all to come, but to come during the international break is the most exciting project the Anfield Wrap has ever done. Supported by Erdinger, we have got a five-part documentary on Jurgen Klopp. Three of those parts will be out in December. It will be a fantastic series of videos. I've seen much of part one, and let me tell you, it is something special. Over 30 interviews done across three or four different countries. We've been to Germany four times. You've not even noticed the join. All of it is to come, but here is the first little audio trailer on the Jurgen Klopp documentary.
He is the king. He is the founder. He is our God. Even the people, they don't know him. Oh, Jurgen Klopp, yeah. It started with him. Everything started with him.
When I retire and stuff like that, if I enjoyed a manager more than him, I'd be surprised. Just the whole experience with him has been absolutely amazing.
The people from Mainz wasn't interested in Mainz 05. That changed when Jürgen was the coach.
From the moment he came here, he was aware that this is about more than just football.
In Dortmund, first is football, maybe family first, but then is Borussia.
He was like, I know how to perform in Europe. I know. This is almost like, this is my competition. This is where the best of me comes out. And when you're sat there in the meeting room listening to that, you're gonna believe that.
That's perfect. Mainz, Dortmund, Liverpool. It couldn't be better. All these clubs have the same heart. It's a football heart. It's a pure football heart with so a lot of passion.
Fabulous stuff there, Klopp, a career in five parts, supported by Erdinger. It is going to be absolutely fantastic on the Anfield Wrap. It is something to look forward to whilst the World Cup is ongoing. Keep your eyes on it in December. That's what we're going to be about. Liverpool 3, Southampton 1 then. Arguably, Paul Senior, the most normal game of the season. It's strange to say, but we get a bit of a soft one early. It's an almost undefendable ball. The game settles down into the pattern you'd expect throughout the rest of the first half. Liverpool win 3-1. You can drop that into any one of Jurgen Klopp's seasons, and it feels like a pretty normal game. It was nice, to be quite honest with you. It was almost run-of-the-mill.
Yeah, it was, yeah. And especially without the manager on the line, you didn't want anything out.
I forgot he wasn't on the line, yeah. And then I looked over and I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it was one of them, and I think that first goal, I mean, if you've travelled that far from Southampton to see that first goal roll in at Anfield, it's not what you want to see. It doesn't set a good precedent for what you think's about to come. And, you know, I don't think it was as home and hosed as maybe some made out, but, it was in the context of looking back at it and in hindsight, that's a better word. It was a pretty routine win. I don't think we were on our swashbuckling
Absolutely not, but
yeah, it was all about the result going into the World Cup, wasn't it? And that's what we got.
We're going to talk about a couple of the players to whom this doesn't apply, Dan, but to me it was a lot of footballers putting in the 6.5 to 7.5 out of 10. And when Liverpool players do that up against a side like Southampton, you expect Liverpool to win the game with a degree of comfort. And that's just sort of what we got. And that's what I sort of mean when I talk about it being normal. Loads of footballers just played pretty averagely by their standards, but guess what? Liverpool's standards are higher than Southampton's standards and so forth, therefore you expect to win.
Yes, enough individual players and the system as a whole were just fine, and fine is more than enough to beat a team
at
the level
fine,
of Southampton.
I'll be honest with you.
That's the issue. They've played extremely well in a few games already this season. So, I mean, they've scored 9, they've scored 7, they've beaten Manchester City twice. So from time to time, hitting a peak hasn't actually been like the overriding issue. It's been being fine on a relatively consistent basis in games where they've supposed to have been fine. They've gone behind in the opening 15 minutes, or they've not looked like they believed in themselves and one another, or whatever, you know, the individual issue in whatever game you want to choose might be. This was the game that should have happened about 6 times in yeah, various different circumstances already this season, but I don't think actually has.
I don't think it's happened once. This is the first time it's happened.
They narrowly beat Newcastle at home, but even that was a mad, you know, winner in the 99th minute or whatever it was. This was the first one where even when it went to 1-1, I was just like, oh, well, that's a shame. It's quite a good goal from their point of view, but this feels like it'll be okay. And they all just seem to believe that as well. There was none of the sort of fatalism psychologically that I think I've had, that they've had about themselves quite a bit. I think also the atmosphere was just fine.
Yeah.
No one kind of went there and was like, "Oh, we've got to do everything possible to get these."
Strong no weirdos rule, I felt.
Exactly. we've got to do everything to get these over the line. Or there also wasn't people getting on the cases of individual players, which has happened in a lot of the games. It was just everyone going, "Yo, we're not going to be here for about 6 weeks, are we? May as well just have a nice time." And it felt like players and crowd were on the same page there. So I enjoyed it. And it looked like they enjoyed just playing a pretty reasonable game of football for once.
The thing they do, Jake, that they haven't been doing is they turn the screw in the first half, and that's the period where they get themselves the 3-1 lead and they deserve to win. And we've actually not seen that much of that. Even when they played well, I don't feel like they've genuinely turned the screw in the way in which I'd like, where the pressure's just mounted and mounted and mounted, either in a 3-minute period or across a 15-minute period, to the point that the opposition are almost willing the quality chance to come, like, because it'll mean we might get a rest for a minute or two. And that's what I think they do really well at 1-1. They just turn the screw on Southampton. They let Southampton punch themselves out and just go, right, now it's our turn. And they were relentless without it being mad in that period of time.
Yeah, I might have helped with the no weirdo reel because I wasn't there. I watched
Yeah.
I watched on a stream at home. One of the benefits of watching with the stream is it wasn't great, so it kept sticking. But you could see the shape. And it was almost like I had my own little Monday night football every 5 minutes, really. The only time I'm ever going to think positive about that. But what it seemed to me is it was very much back to basic. It was back to the shape that we've been playing for the last 3, 4, 5 years. Bobby doing what Bobby does, the three in midfield. Nunes looked like he was doing his best impression of Mane, in a lot, especially off the ball, I would say. And I think you see the benefits in that with the results and with the performance. But what I will say about Southampton is they're a lot more stoked than I thought they were.
Very muscular, aren't they? Yeah. Very muscular. A big size.
Yeah, I'm into it as well. Yeah, I mean, we needed somebody to take the mantle after Burnley went down on behalf of the big lads. So, yeah, I'm happy with that.
Do you think there's enough for them to finish 17th, Southampton? Because, I mean, let's be honest, it's the thing we're all talking about.
I think so, but I also don't know anything about the manager. Like, for me, he could be, like, the next big thing, or he could be a PE teacher. I've honestly got no idea.
They seem very excited about him, don't they? You can see that he got a bit of a
right
wall
behind Jonesy.
Yeah, they were right behind him. And I'm with you, Jake. I must admit, I don't know much about him. I've probably never heard of him until disappointed him, and that might say more about me than them.
I think it says the fact that you're a busy man in his 30s who's got a job.
Maybe, mate. It might be that is true, but. It was an unenviable task for him. First day coming to Anfield. I know we've lost there recently, but the last couple of years it's been an absolute fortress, hasn't it?
The reason why I think they might have 17th in them, Dan, is they look like they could score a goal. And that's, again, without sort of labouring the point, that's the issue with a fair few of the sides down at the bottom is you're not quite clear how they could score a goal. Now, it's funny this because Che Adams has got a certain reputation. Firstly, I couldn't get over the size of him. He is an absolutely huge. I thought he was great. His movement was brilliant. The goal they get, it's an almost indefendable ball, to be honest with you. It's that good from Ward-Prowse. And I think that's the first league goal we've conceded from a set piece in the league this season, to be clear, an opposition set piece. We've been absolutely mustered at conceding from our own set pieces. Best in the country by some distance, all the metrics show it. But that was part of why I sort of came away from it feeling like, yeah, that was a good game of football. They're not two great sides. You know, we've got the potential to be. But we were tested in areas because they weren't dreadful, if you know what I mean. It wasn't like a Bournemouth thing or anything like that.
Yeah, I think I probably came away from it thinking that they were a better team than both Nottingham Forest and Leeds, who Liverpool have lost to. Therefore, the difference was the level of performance that Liverpool were at in those respective games. But I think they've got a number of good players in key positions. You know, Adams is not prolific, but a presence and holds the ball up really quite well. As you were saying, you know, he was smart in and around the box in terms of stealing himself 2 or 3 yards of space to get on the end of something. With Ward-Prowse, they've always got someone that can either create or score a goal from any set piece, essentially, because he's that good at doing it.
He's so good at them.
He's unbelievably good. I can't really be asked with loads of fucking World Cup squad chats, but I think it's mad that he's available and hasn't been taken, because with 5 minutes left, if you've got a flood of your corners, I'd quite like to have him taking them. And I really like Bella Kotchap, who had a few really iffy moments, notably the one where he passed it to Salah and then should have given a penalty away, really, I think. But other times I thought he read it really well. He's really strong. He's got a decent range of passing that he showed quite a few times, and he's 19. I feel like they've got a squad that in 2 or 3 years' time will be really good. You know, Lavia looks a good player as well. Yeah. It might just be that it's not quite enough now to keep them up, but then it might piss the championship if they were to go down next season and have, what by the sounds of it, is quite a good manager. But I'm interested in watching them more than I was previously, I think, because maybe just sort of doing the same thing under Hasenhüttl felt like it was all, we've just been doing this for too long at this point. Sometimes that happens with a footy team, doesn't it? Especially considering a lot of those Southampton players have been there for that whole time. So maybe it's just worth doing something a little bit different. And I thought they looked like they had a lot of intelligent players, and you know, that's a solid foundation from which to go with.
He's got a lot to work with, hasn't he? I think the main thing on the two players that we spoke about, Che Adams and James Ward-Prowse, you build around them and you hope that this young, enthusiastic prospects can sort of come up to their level and be inspired by them. I think looking at them at the weekend, I would imagine they'll be fine. They just don't want to concede goals like the first. But if you can knock that on the head with working with this manager, and this manager's got what now, 6 weeks to work with them,
and only one of them's going away.
Well, there you go. That is the main thing, and I think that's going to save a lot, not just Southampton, but a lot of teams down there. Well, especially it's a good time to change a manager. I'm never going to be an advocate for that, but. You know, if you're a club that's not getting very many results and you think your manager was good a couple of weeks ago, but maybe he isn't, it might be a good time to have a little look at him.
Might be indeed, but you never know.
I wouldn't want to offer that advice.
No. Part of where I think that's why that's good, Paul, for us, is we get to see something, and what we get to see is the goalkeeper. I mean, I think Liverpool were going to win that game no matter what. I'll be dead honest about it. I think if they'd have gone 3-2, Liverpool would have gone 4-5. It's interesting to me when Mo should get the penalty is immediately after they've just had one of the one-on-ones with the keeper. It was almost like we just went up the other end and it's mad to me. A, it's not a penalty, and B, it's not a VAR penalty after the fact. But parking that for a second, the goalkeeper is simply incredible when he's called into action, and that save from the Che Adams header is genuinely one of the best saves I can ever remember seeing live at Anfield.
He's the way I can describe him is when other teams get a chance, I don't worry anymore. And that, I think that's the biggest compliment I can give him, is he's calmed me down so much. When other teams used to get a corner or other teams used to get into that position, you panic so much, and you just one-on-one for especially, you just back him every time. But then seeing saves like the ones he's made at the weekend, you just remember he can also do the other bits as well. He's he's the best I've ever seen. And I thought, you know, Reina was great. There was a large period at the time where he was unbelievable. But Alisson's way, way, way and above where he is. I don't know where we would be without him. I would hate to think of a world without him. But yeah, he's tremendous.
Everything he does, Jake, is just magnificent. I mean, you know, he's very rarely at fault. A goalkeeper will be every now and again. Every goalkeeper's got one in them somewhere, especially one who takes as many risks as he does. I think the strangest thing about him is that the number of times someone will go close that one around something Alisson's done in any way, shape or form, and yet close, but the bad thing hasn't happened. And over again, he's incredible at that. He's brilliant in the one-on-ones, as Paul says. That save from the Adams header is just breathtaking, genuinely breathtaking. Yeah. And he's pulling stuff like that out every other week at times. And we can maybe have a chat about that in general. But my word, he is just simply amazing.
Yeah, it was a 9.5 out of 10 performance. I think I'll need to be marked down with the fact that he'd had a shave and didn't look quite as handsome as he normally does. But yeah, no, he's brilliant, isn't it? And actually, I think we're at a point now where he's widely considered the best goalkeeper to ever play for the club, isn't he? And I think, you know, even my granddad would admit that, you know, to say in a nice way. But I'm actually looking at the landscape of football at the moment and thinking the way that it's changed with him, the Neuer before him, Edison, you know, how long is it before we're looking at these as some of the best footballers?
Yeah.
Genuinely, you know, especially the way that the game's being now, the high lines, the coming out sweeper keeper. And I think, genuinely, if you were to name your sort of top 10, 15 greatest ever Liverpool players, he's got to be in with a shout.
It's high praise, Jake, but it's deserved. And, you know, Dan, you get to see it at the weekend. It's incredible. As I say, the save was, people's breath was taken in the ground. You very rarely hear that sort of noise. Certainly from a save, there's normally at least someone shouting that someone should have done better. There wasn't even any of that. There was just, it was great football all around from them. And then he does what he does.
Yeah, even when Liverpool have been playing really poorly this season, I've still been surprised when the ball ends up in the net, because a bit like Paul was saying, I just sort of don't take for granted that he's going to save it, but I always give him probably an over 50% chance of saving anything, even some stuff that when you watch it back would go, well, yeah, he had no chance at that, but in the moment you think that he does. So many chances get missed as well by opposition players that don't even hit the target, because they know that it's got to be almost perfect. Unless you've had a ball played across the 6-yard box, he's at his near post and you're at the far post and they're going to tap it in. If you're sort of corner of the penalty area and are trying to put something in the far corner, you've got to really put it in that corner or he's going to save it. And I think there have been portions of his Liverpool career, and this is one of them, when you are often seeing players try to score a more precise goal than what they would really need to do against pretty much anyone else, because they know who they're coming up against and they know, well, this fella's an awful lot more likely to save this if I put it within what you would say is reasonable distance. If I give him a chance of saving this, he might well do. So I'm going to try and be perfect with it. If you try and hit a shot perfectly, then there's a chance he just absolutely blam it wide, or you aim for the far corner and it goes just past the post or whatever. That's a really important psychological power as well, because he obviously does save an awful lot of the things, but by having a reputation for saving an awful lot of the things, he makes the others miss sometimes, yeah, if that makes sense. So I think it's been the case in every season that he's played for Liverpool, and it certainly is now. The amount of goals that Liverpool have actually conceded is fewer than what they should have conceded. And an awful lot of that, yes, is down to brilliant saves. Like the other day, that chance will be pretty high XG for Adosie at the end, for example. But he makes the save, so Liverpool conceded fewer goals than they should have in that match. But also some other ones that should go in are missed because the lads just put them wide, because they're really trying to beat him. Not just beat him, but really beat him. And that makes a significant difference then to not just the amount of goals that Liverpool concede, but therefore the results. So it's kind of, there's a sort of dual power to that.
Wasn't there an offside one with Che Adams at the cop end where he misses? And you could see that absolutely what you're saying there is he's absolutely tried to put it just in that square in the net and obviously missed. But I think just to draw a line under Alisson, I think you're right in saying top 15. We used to do that 100 players who shook the cop thing. I'd like to see a revisited edition with that and see where he sits, because as you say, like some of my dad and granddad, Clements, no gloves, all this sort of stuff, there's not even a chat in my mind about that anymore.
He's probably been our outstanding performer this season. That needs to change from Boxing Day, Jake, and there's a couple of candidates who could well take it off, and one is Darwin Nunez. I think it's important to be really clear, I thought, about Saturday, in that he gets two goals, but it's actually just a really good all-round performance. I think he's, you mentioned before about sort of off the ball, moving a little bit like Mane. I thought he joined play up really well when he came inside, linked nicely, was lively, obviously then also gets the two goals. It's just a consummate, rock-solid performance from a footballer. It's, with the added Darwin-ness of the whole thing.
Yeah, he's come in like a bull in the china shop, hasn't he? And, a lot's been made about it. And actually, I think you could see how much he was pent up and how much he wanted to kind of be the main man and make the difference. And it's gone both ways, I would say, at times. It's looked brilliant, but it's also looked terrible. And we know the discipline. But actually, what was great about the weekend, and I would say the past sort of 10 days, 2 weeks, is it's just been good.
Yeah.
And that's what we needed, especially with the goals that left the team. He needs to come in, not only score goals, but play a part in that system. And for me, the evidence of that is starting to roost, and I'm all for it. And he's, incredibly handsome.
He is incredibly handsome, Paul. And we've got to bear it in mind. It's also just nice to see him happy, because he really loves scoring goals in the way in which there's I think that there's footballers. We're lucky to, but we've got another couple of those, I think, who just love scoring goals, and Salah and Jota just absolutely love it as well. And that's one of the things that marks out the goal scorer. He's joyous in that, and the relationship with him and Salah's just absolutely fascinating, to be honest with you. I think they're both potentially prolific at any given moment.
I'm in love with the lad, honestly. I'm infatuated by him. I think his ceiling is just ridiculously high. You've seen some things from him that haven't gone in the back of the net, which has been there's one game where he had a little Van Basten effort, wasn't there?
He's had three of them now.
Yeah, There's gonna be a day where people sit up and take note of him, and it's coming. And the saddest thing about the World Cup coming now is he's just about getting there.
Well, my worry is Uruguay gonna get it. Well, Uruguay gonna get this hat trick, this four, where he's just hits four things first half, and they all go in, and Uruguay winning some sort of mad game 4-0.
Quite possibly. Like you wouldn't rule him out for a golden boot, would you? Might be a sensible bet. But yeah, I get really upset when he's not in the team. I just want to watch him, and that's it. In the sort of mad bastard way in which he is, and the way some things don't come off, I'm still all for it because he tries them and he backs himself. But the performance of the weekend in particular was an all round sort of centre forward playing off the left sort of way. And his hold up play was good. His distribution was good. He brought other players into the game. He had the fullback one on one a few times. This is literally a footballer that can do everything. And I know there's a lot of Haaland and him chat, but if you can take them both on their own merits, Haaland's a fantastic footballer. Parking. Let's look at Darwin Nunes, just as him. There's a real young, outstanding footballer there that Liverpool are going to be a huge beneficiary of over the next couple of years. I've never been so certain of anything in my life.
When, Dan, you used to sort of look at the way, you know, you look at the side from, say, the January of 2018, specifically, but not solely, through to if you want to go all the way to May 2022, fine. If you want to pull it a little bit earlier, okay. One of the things that I thought Liverpool were brilliant at was you play 4-3-3, but it actually felt a bit like 4-4-4, if you know what I mean, because of what the way players were able to do so much stuff at once. I think Nunez, that to me is his first performance where at his peak playing off the left, Mane. That idea that between Mane and Salah, they had the occupying force of three attackers, minimum, maybe even more. And I thought you really got to see that for the first time. Not just the idea of Nunez in flashes, he can do this, he can do that, but it was the first time I sort of thought, no, this can overwhelm a team, and then there's room for someone else to function because they're doing all this as well. And then that other person can also be helping the midfield as well because they can help make out those battles a little bit easier. That midfield can stretch itself. They've always got an out ball in either direction. You know, that's what I mean when I sort of talk about it being complete. To me, it felt for the first time like you've got two being three because they're so powerful.
I remember writing a thing about Mane about 3 or 4 years ago about his defensive contribution to Liverpool and comparing him to like other sort of top-level players that play on the left wing, and the amount of like interceptions, tackles, ball recoveries, whatever metrics it was at the time he was making was like five times as many as anyone like Neymar or Hazard. I can't remember who else was in the list. And that meant that a right back that was playing against Sadio Mane would first of all have to deal with trying to stop Sadio Mane. And then when they made a rare attempt at going forward and supporting their team, I think, fucking hell, this fella again. Like, he's going to do that as well, as he? I hadn't realised that. And I think that Nunes has shown flashes of that in other games, but in this one as well, it felt like he was just in all areas of the pitch at different points. You know, he was popping up in the box, in the centre of the attack for his goals. It felt like he was coming back to sort of do a little bit at left back quite a bit. There was sometimes he was in centre mid, and I think that's
what
he's
been right hand side. He's with Elliot for a couple of minutes,
and I think that's what you used to see from Mane was that yes, when Liverpool kicked off, he stood on the left wing, but he did an awful lot of other stuff as well. In all different parts of the pitch, and that's what made him so hard for anybody to play against. You know, I mentioned the opposition right back there, but he was given centre mids a tough time who didn't think that he was any of their responsibility in an awful lot of games. I think one of the thing that sort of pleased me most about Nunes the other day was not the goals, because we've seen he can do goals already, that's fine. But in a lot of the games so far, I think he's done the instinct stuff extremely well. So when he's just kicking the ball dead hard at the goal, or heading it dead hard at the goal, or making a run because someone's about to play a pass to him, I think he's been great. When he's had a decision to make or time on the ball is when sometimes he's done something mad and terrible. But in a few games, I think Ajax was one. I think Tottenham was one. In a few games, his decision making has looked a bit better. He's looked a bit smarter. And this the other day, he did everything really well. All of his decision making was really good. He was, as everyone has said, he was bringing people into play, but also he was picking like moments to press really well. He was doing the defensive contribution. It just felt like he was being an awful lot more intelligent compared to some of the previous performances. And I think that's an enormous step forward, because it's really hard to have been dropped into this Liverpool team to be replacing someone that was so important when they're having such a bad time for a really sustained period, and to be asked to not just score goals, but also do the other stuff. So he's got the goals, that's fine. And now if Liverpool are going to play a bit better, it seems like he is capable of doing the other stuff as well. And that's really important, because I think you can't just score goals in this Liverpool team. I know that scoring goals is really difficult, but all of the players that have been successful scoring goals for Liverpool in the past few years have done 10, 15 other things absolutely brilliantly as well. You know, the goalkeeper can't just be a goalkeeper. He has to get assists and stuff as well if this Liverpool team is to be at its most effective. So I think if he's going to pick that stuff up as well, and what is in the grand scheme of things quite quickly, because he's only been here for 3 or 4 months, then that's an excellent sign, because that's to my mind the hardest stuff for him to actually do. He's always, from when he was probably about 8 years old, scored loads of goals. That doesn't mean it's easy when you go to the Premier League and start doing it, but it's the thing that he's always had a knack for, and that he in his mind feels instinctively he knows how to do. The other stuff is what's totally new. Having to play these various different positions at once, starting on the left and having someone else, you know, on the other wing, be the main fella really in the team. So that's what's new to him. And if that performance there, where, again, I don't think he was absolutely brilliant.
No.
But he just did everything very well. If that's a sign of what's to come, then he'll be a superb Liverpool player.
I could bring you in a second, Jake. I'll come back to you first. And what I liked about it in the end was that it felt like a really, again, and not dissimilar to the whole team, it felt like a really mundane. He's had an 8.5 out of 10 there, and he's also scored 2, if you see what I mean. And that was the bit that I sort of most liked. Yeah. He's just done football, to be honest with you, as you'd expect someone to do.
He was just very, very efficient. Whenever he had the ball, whenever he was off the ball and someone was looking to find him, he was pretty much always making the right run. He was directing play when he had the ball. He was switching it to the right man, rather than, you know, sometimes there are games where he's had 3 potential options and he's invented a 4th shit one and lost the ball. But there was none of that the other day. He just felt like he did the sensible and efficient things. And if he's going to be, you know, a really talented goal scorer and a very efficient player as well, then that's a brilliant combination. And that's the kind of thing that the really successful Liverpool attackers in the past few years, whether it be Mane, Salah, Firmino, Jota, have all done.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where the Haaland comparisons have got to stop as well, because, you know, although they're both sort of shiny new centre-forwards with ponytails, I don't see Haaland doing doggies on the left-hand side or the right-hand side. And that's the difference, you know. I think whatever team Darwin Nunes has played for, probably in his life up until now, maybe by Uruguay, it's been built around him scoring goals, whereas this Liverpool team's always been built around the system. And I think, like you said, that's what we saw on Saturday. And if you asked sort of, you know, clips, bits of content that you've seen, how many you've seen over the years, you know, you were talking about your article there, how many sort of defenders or journalists or whatever have said, you know, Sadio Mane gives you the hardest game in the Premier League. I always remember Danny Rose coming off once against Tottenham, and he was absolutely steaming, like, and he couldn't believe what he'd just come up against. And I think if you asked, was it Walker Peters right back on Saturday, I think you'd ask Walker Peters, you know, how did he get on Saturday there? I think he'd be coming off the same.
I remember me and you enjoying that clip a lot. It was when Mane was playing down the right for Liverpool, and Danny Rose was just absolutely dunning by him. And you can see games like that where it's going to be like this for full-backs in the future. And I think you're right. If it was it Walker Peters? Was it a right back for them at the weekend?
Al-Wanissi started right wing back.
This guy.
That's stream, man.
this guy I don't know either has had a hard afternoon, and I think there'll be plenty of full-backs feeling the same for the rest of the season.
The midfield then, Dan, I think you got to see a little bit. It was the area where, and listen, you've been, again, saying this about successful Liverpool sides as well, let's be clear. You know, you got to see bits and pieces of the best and the worst over the course of the 90 minutes. You felt as though when Southampton were playing the football and were showing the power, we were maybe played around a little bit too easy. But then the flip side of that was you got to see the absolute quality. Elliott's ball for the goal that makes it 2-1 to Nunez is exactly why Liverpool are so committed to him in that position from the outset. You know, it's instinctive, it's wonderful, it swirls in a perfect way. And and it gambles it back to the teammates as well. And the other part of that as well, where I've got a bit of sympathy for Elliot, you know, even though up to that point he was sort of doing me head in a little bit, is that sides just really overload that space playing against Liverpool. It's in part because of Trent Alexander-Arnold. It's in part because it's the side that's not Van Dijk. It's in part because you've got to attack somewhere. It's in part because Salah plays furthest forward, so there's more space. All of these things mean that that's where the game is going to occur. But the fact that, you know, Elliot gets that wonderful ball just justifies almost everything, to be honest with you. You got to see the quality of his touch over and over.
Yeah, it's a significant difference from what they were doing before, when it was, well, by and large, Fabinho, Henderson and Wijnaldum, in that was three footballers who had different skill sets and stuff, but were by and large asked to win the ball back, and when they have it, move it to their wing side as quickly as possible so that the creative / goal scoring players can do the rest. So Liverpool would end up being 2-3-5 the majority of the time. Having a player now who is, they're asking to score or create goals is relatively new, and that might sound strange because midfielders in theory do that, but Liverpool's players weren't asked to do that, and it worked extremely well. And that does mean that there's an offset somewhere else. It's about establishing whether they feel that offset is therefore worth it. And I think in the long run it will be, because he's such a special player. You know, that ball that he plays for the first Nunes goal, there are not many players that play for top level teams that can do that across Europe, and there are certainly even fewer of them who are 19. So to have that level of ability to play the pass in general. Secondly, the ability to actually do it in a match scenario. And thirdly, the sort of composure and self-belief to just back himself to do it, I think is really interesting, and is something that Liverpool definitely need to be building around going forward. It just means that, therefore, if you're going to have a player like that, the other two playing that midfield, therefore, need to do more than what, as a three, the Liverpool midfielders used to do, because you're going to have somebody who, by the mere fact that he is 5'7" or something like that and quite slight, is not going to be able to win the ball back as much, never ever. Even if he gets loads better at positioning, even if he just plays loads of football and understands it an awful lot more, he's not going to be able to win it back as often as somebody like Wijnaldum was able to do. So that means that, therefore, yeah, whoever is playing as the eight on the other side and the six behind him are going to have to be shuffling across to the right more often in order to do that job, especially as you say, if Alexander-Arnold and Salah are going to be the players over there as well. But I think that that's worth it. There might be some games where, you know, for the next couple of years, you think maybe it's not. Maybe if you, I don't know, going away to Real Madrid and they're not outside the Champions League, for example, you might think it's better to just sort of do retro three midfielders who are asked to give the ball to the others and that kind of thing. But in the majority of the games that Liverpool play, they're going to be the better team and have most of the ball. And therefore, having someone on the ball who is more talented with it at his feet than anyone else, I think, really, in an attacking area is really important. You know, Thiago has got an amazing range of passing, but he doesn't get loads of assists.
Never has.
Never throws his career. He's not that kind of passer. He's have it in a relatively deep area and do that sort of half-turn, mad body switch thing that plays it to someone who can then run with the ball and then make a chance. He's not the sort of chance maker. Whereas Elliot can be, and that's a different dimension for Liverpool that I think, from time to time, you still see them trying to get used to. You know, there are sometimes where he's got the ball on the edge of the box, and I think people forget that they should therefore make a run, because they're probably used to just, oh, well, it's Fabinho, so he's just going to play it to the other wing, or it's Henderson, so he's going to play that clip ball to the back post. It's almost like, oh, it's Harvey. I need to make a dart for him because he'll do that. But as time goes by, as he plays more and more and as they get more used to him, I think it's going to be such a weapon for Liverpool. It just means that whoever is playing as those two, whether they are current Liverpool players or whether they are future Liverpool players potentially, are going to have that little bit more graft to themselves.
Yeah, I mean, what you first started with, I think for a lad of his age, the composure and just knowing you've got the time to just stop and create that ball at 19 years of age is something quite special. But I think in terms of the wider midfield, I think things will get even easier for Harvey once Fabinho, I hope Fabinho sorts himself out. I think he's not been as bad as he has been in recent games, but he's still not quite at his best. And I think that will obviously put a bit more pressure, a bit more exposure on the midfield and therefore the defence. And I think that's why we are conceding silly goals. We do need to hope post-World Cup we get the Fabinho we know and love back, and that will unlock so many more things, but also just take that little bit of pressure off Elliot, where he can do more of that sort of thing, where he's not having to look over his shoulder all the time or go and cover a fullback or whatnot. I think that will be important. Also having a fit Jordan Henderson again around him, and hopefully a couple of rested players. I think Elliott's got a real bright future. I just think I'm not sure he's going to hit quite the heights that I thought he was. Maybe at one point he's not got that extra yard of pace that I'd like him to have or whatnot. I think the same can maybe apply for Cavalier, where I maybe thought Elliott was going to be like top draw, and maybe I think he'll be a very good footballer, but maybe not quite as elite as I was hoping for. But he's definitely got some tools, and I'd love to be wrong on him, but yeah, he's a really good all rounded technical footballer. But I think that lack of physicality that could hold him back a little bit. But I think it will all be helped if those around him start performing a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with Paul there. I think I've been sort of unsure at times. But I think the problem he has in the position that he has and the kind of responsibility that demands is he kind of needs to be making a difference. Otherwise, it's what the point is he doing there? And, you know, there's midfielders that we love. You know, I think he's probably the most sort of a Guardiola-type midfielder that Liverpool have, in essence. I know there's Thiago there, you could argue as well, but he is very much in that mould of what Bernardo Silva's trying to do, and I think that's an interesting thing on its own, but and what David Silva did before him potentially as well. But they always had Yaya Toure next to them. They always have Fernandinho. They've now got Rodri, and I think that is going to be a big thing in the essence how far Harvey can go. Who's he going to have next to him?
But I think on all of this, though, the conversation both from Dan and from Paul, Jake, and it's almost in a sense unfair, though I'm sure he'd revel in the responsibility. I think everyone finds 10% more when Konate comes back
100%.
Week in, week out, because the reason is everyone is 5 to 10 yards higher up the pitch.
Yeah.
So Harvey's doing his first touch rather than be 40 yards from goal, he's doing it 30 yards from goal, and guess what? You get that one right and the world opens up for you. And that, I think that, and it's really funny, it's a really strange journey that I think Liverpool centre-halves have sort of gone on, where I think 3 years ago, quite obviously the most important one was Virgil van Dijk. I think because of the injuries with Gomez, but also I think Gomez's instincts and where Virgil's maybe just ended up after his injury a teeny little bit, these are slightly more back-footed defenders now. Matip's growing a little bit older. I think this is back to, if you've got Konate, whoever he's next to, as weird as that might be to say, we'd always rather he was next to Virgil right now. But I think whoever he's next to, you're able to say, everyone's 5 to 10 yards higher up the pitch. Suddenly Fabinho's got less ground to cover. He's more able to come and fill that gap. Suddenly Harvey's starting earlier, starting higher up the pitch. Suddenly Trent's higher up the pitch. You know, I think the extent to which all of that flips, I think, is massive for them.
Yeah, I mean, it's hugely relevant. I mean, especially because it tends to be the right-hand side.
That's what I mean, yeah, as well. Yeah,
that Harvey's occupying, you know what I mean? I can see that 100%, you know, if we can go 10 yards higher with him. I mean, there's not much more we can go higher, Neil. I don't, you know, but you can't be offside in there, Ralph.
But you watch Konate, he'll come and win it. He'll come and win it 35 yards from the opponent's goal. If he thinks it's there to be won, he'll come the whole way, and and his attitude will be, well, if I don't win it the first time, I'll win it off you running backwards.
He's hugely important, Konate. And listen, I'm a Joe Gomez fan. I'm still, I think, a little bit going on pre-Burnley injury and hoping that we can get back to that. But he's been better this season than last. But Konate is another level of importance. I think if you speak to football fans outside of our bubble, they won't realise just the importance of Konate to Liverpool. But he is fastly becoming as important a footballer as we've got. We just need him available. I'm so disappointed. I'm pleased for him, but I'm so disappointed he's in that French squad. I'd have loved him to have just had 6 weeks getting fit, maybe working on whatever it is that's wrong with him, because he is going to be as important a footballer as we've got.
I think having him and Matip is really, really useful to Liverpool, because you mentioned there about Liverpool are able to start higher up the pitch when Konate plays, and that's definitely true. I think Matip also is very good at getting Liverpool up the pitch, but in a different way. He's obviously nowhere near as quick, but at the moment anyway, he's much better in possession, so he's better at playing Liverpool up the pitch or carrying the ball up the pitch.
Both, and that means both passing and carrying,
And that means that depending on the opposition that Liverpool are playing, I know that you know, by and large, probably one of them is going to be absent because of the records, so you're just probably picking whoever you've got. But if Liverpool were to be in a a second leg of a European Cup semi-final or a European Cup final or FA Cup final or whatever, I think it's perfectly reasonable to say, well, Van Dijk obviously plays, and then who are we playing against? Because either way, we've got two centre-halves here. The first of all, are excellent, just the general defending and stuff like that, but they're also enable everybody else to play higher up in one way or the other. So is it a case of, well, we're playing against a really fast attack and therefore we want to restrict the space in the middle of the pitch so it's less likely the ball can go over the top, in which case you play Konate? Or are we going to have loads of possession here? Are we maybe the better team against another particularly fast attack? Therefore, maybe the lad who's better with the ball
Had the benefit of doing that. Nowhere near as often as we'd like as well.
But it means that either way, you've got, you know, if only one of them is fit, there's an enormous benefit to either player. I think that, obviously Liverpool has defended an awful lot less well this season than what they have under Klopp previously. But I think those pair of centre-halves as your second choice, effectively, centre-half, is an amazing pair to be picking between, because I think they're both absolutely excellent.
Okay, the bigger picture then, Jake. Been poor, but hung on, it's fair to say, in the top four picture. Not great, let's not, we're not going to sugarcoat it, but Champions League, obviously, got to the last 16, still in the EFL Cup insofar as that matters, and there's the FA Cup as well. But the top four situation, Chelsea don't look great. Spurs and United both look full of character, if not quality. It's worth saying that, it's another couple of last-minute winners or equalisers that both have shown in the last few weeks, and you've got to respect that. Newcastle hanging on to another tight one. But if this is a quality conversation, I come back to the fact that, we'll work out where Arsenal are in general. There's obviously Manchester City. For me, Liverpool are at worst third if it comes down to quality application and approach and a bit of luck, because that will filter into it, is the question mark as far as I'm concerned, and obviously injuries as well.
Yeah, I mean, this was always going to be a mad season, and, we won't go there why. It's been widely documented and been done, but I've always thought if we hang on there till we get to this point, then coming back out of that the other side, then we'll see where we end up. And I think we've just about managed to kind of cling in there, and we're starting to look good, which is great. And the reason why I've always thought that is because if you pulled each manager and asked them for a pint or a coffee or a glass of wine, whatever the tip would be, and say, who would you rather play against? Arsenal, Liverpool. Who would you rather play against? Spurs, Liverpool. Who would you rather play against? Man United, Liverpool. They're picking the opposition all the time. And as far as I'm concerned, there's however many points to play for, and we go and get them after the break.
That's got to be the spirit, Paul. There's a lot of points to play for because of the two games that we've lost as well, going all the way through here. It's worth remembering that. You feel like this in everyone's heads, it feels a bit like a halfway mark. It's not even that at this point. It's much closer to a third of the season than it is to halfway through the season. There is a lot of points to play for. When we get back, from the minute we get back, it's time to go and get them.
Absolutely. And I think Jake's right in what he's saying there. Liverpool is still going to be feared. Real Madrid aren't delighted with that draw, defending champions. No, Manchester City won't be delighted with that draw in the League Cup, not at all. Nobody wants to play Liverpool, never mind. I mean, our problem has been against Leeds and Nottingham Forest, not against Manchester City.
Yeah.
And that's what I mean
when I talk about approach.
Yeah, well, 100%. And there's no doubt in Liverpool are out of form and have got some problems that they need to rectify. Well, when we get back from the World Cup, firstly, the transfer window will be about to open. I'd like to think that we can do something in that midfield. I wouldn't hold my breath, but I wouldn't be surprised if we did try and do something. The World Cup is a reset. It's an opportunity for the likes of Jota, Diaz to get fit, and we'll look very, very different when we come back. Hopefully, and touch wards that the World Cup doesn't throw us a bad one, which it can do, but it can also do that to other clubs as well. So when we come back from this, I expect Liverpool to have been worked on. I imagine that shape will look different. Are they going to Dubai? Am I right in saying?
They're going somewhere.
So there'll be a little bit of warm weather training and whatever. It might be good for spirits. I don't know the last time. This is a longer period than pre-season. When's this manager and this coaching staff had this amount of time to work with that amount of lads?
Borussia Dortmund.
Well, never at Liverpool yet. So there's your answer, isn't it? So on the training ground, there's no coaching team I'd like more than ours to work with a team and get them right. So I think this is a really important period for us. And we've got an uphill battle, but this squad, this team, this manager has absolutely backed them to fight it.
I obviously take the coaching point and that they'll be working really hard over the break and stuff like that. But I'd also really like them to just not do anything for 2 weeks. or something, you know, whatever the sort of reasonable sports science
time period is,
just not do anything. Because, you know, in the summer they came back and they worked really hard. It seems like probably too hard. They've played so much football over so many years. That I hope there's some space built.
No, they
got
a couple of weeks.
Well, that's good then for them to just say, you know, do whatever, do your weights and your yoga and whatever, and you stretch in at home, but don't do any more intense.
I'm giving myself a couple of weeks to be honest with you. I'm waiting till the knockout stages.
They're going to be doing playing badminton with me and you.
but more importantly, don't think about football.
No,
take your family on holiday. Do normal human being things.
Go to the
and then come back mid December. Absolutely determined to play loads of football all the time and do really well.
Don't go to the rugby league, though. don't go
Speedway.
Yeah, go sit in a cabana by a beach or something, but don't go to the rugby league.
Because they found that energy in the second half of last season, but while still playing, they just sort of got to the point where it was, you know, they were 14 points behind City and then ended up just a point. So they managed to find it there. Hopefully some sort of rest and refresh, I think, is actually more important than like even the tactical stuff, because I think a lot of the tactical stuff is, can we just fucking do what we were doing before? Like, I know there are some new players, but that was fine. We did that mad change of shape that didn't end up working. If we can just get back to the point where everyone is physically and mentally able to do the things that we've always done, then we'll be grand. So I think, you know, there are still, you know, yeah, technical things to do on that sort of point. But more than anything, I just hope that they rest and don't think about footy for a while.
Yeah, getting in umbrella hats is what we want to see.
I want to see more hammocks and less hackers, because that's all I know.
Tremendous stuff. But even bigger picture is the sale, Paul. There's very mixed messages at the moment about how long this will take. In the first place, you think, is this all because something's already in the works? Then there's talk of, well, there might be another couple of windows. In the coverage, there's hugely mixed messages to the point that stories are almost coming out as downright contradictory. My funny thing on this is, do timescales sort of truly matter? And then, of course, in the grand scheme of things, yes, it would. But it feels as though what's not going to happen, not going to be allowed to happen, if you are thinking about selling the asset from the point of view of a hedge fund, is you're not going to let it decrease in value. And that to me is, you know, is almost the marked thing here, is that if the plan is, and we still don't know because there's no clarity on that either, if the plan is for Fenway Sports Group to exit, they're not going to want to exit with the value worth any less than it is right now. And that's, you know, when people are thinking, considering January, for instance, in amongst all of these sort of computations, that's the bit where I'm just a little bit, if there's something to be done, they'll try to find a way to get it done, because the one thing they're not going to want to do is have someone turning up and offering them 500, half a billion less than they might have got in the first place.
Listen, the sort of economic theory on any of this is really basic. If you've got something that somebody wants, then you might be willing to put it up for sale. If there's something that a couple of people want, then you can start a bit more. But it's the same in whether you're selling your house or what. If your house has been on the sale for 2 minutes and there's loads of people viewing it, then yes, you're in good stead. If you look on Rightmove and it says it's been on the market since February this year, you know you can get a bargain. FSG aren't stupid. That's the one thing. They've took an asset and they've 10 times its value in, what, 12 years that they've had the club, pretty much. So, yeah, they're not soft. They'll have high level interest. They'll have had an offer. I reckon it might not be where they are or where they want to be, and now they're saying, well, here we are, come and get us. And they might be willing to retain some of it. I would be surprised. I think the Mike Gordon stuff that you heard in the week tells you that he's going to be working with banks and getting ready for a full-blown sale and transitioning the club from this ownership to the next. I don't know who it'll be. I have no idea. I think a lot of the things that our fan base feel in terms of state ownership and stuff like that will be avoided. I think FSG know that they have to do the right thing. And I think maybe some of the people that were knocking on the door or what they would class as the right thing, they're never going to be the purest, cleanest people in the world at that level. You'd imagine it'll be a consortium containing some billionaires or a very, very rich family. You know, there's talk of the Indian family that's got huge billions of assets across the world. But they're never going to be a lad from Tubrook. Do you know what I mean? It's not going to be that. So we've got to be realistic in what we're getting and look at the quality of other football owners out there. But what we want to do is have, what's the word that they always use, custodians of the club that's going to treat them with the same respect, I'd say, that FSG have done with Liverpool in the last, they've learned a few hard lessons. I think they've learned them, they've been prepared to learn. Yeah, and they have. And I think if you talk to people who deal with the club in a charitable status or whatever, the, you know, without naming names, I know a few people who are doing that at the moment, and it's not some person in a department in Chapel Street. It's right at the top that they're dealing with. They're dealing with your Mike Gordons, they're dealing with your Billy Hogans daily, and they're working with these charities to do better for the people of the city and wider stakeholders. So I think what the next ownership need to do is maybe be told a few stories by the current ownership about where they went wrong and what they did, and hopefully they're a bit more ambitious in the transfer market. And, you know, if we can have owners of the same values, I would say, as FSG, that are maybe a little bit more ambitious in the transfer market, then I'm all for it.
The whole thing is quite confusing and just led to an awful lot of speculation, because that's what they invited by saying the specific things that they said, where they didn't overtly say, yes, we want to say the whole of this thing, but they also didn't not say it, because again, the sort of raw economics of it, if you were to come out and say, yeah, we definitely do want to sell this thing, then you probably knock a little bit off the price, because it sounds like you're in a rush. It sounds like you definitely want to get out. If you just say, well, we're open minded about any possibility, then that sort of starts you at a higher negotiating point, but also therefore means that everything is just kind of up in the air. It means that anyone who in theory has the finance can come and knock and say, well, should we have a chat and you know, where do we start in, and that sort of thing. That obviously means that takes longer, because it's not overtly, well, we're selling this amount or this is the price or whatever. And also the fact that they are instructing these banks to do the work, and their sort of main man, by the sounds of it from the story this week, Gordon, is now being tasked with managing that process. You know, I understand why a lot of people's reaction was to say, oh, well, they haven't said that they want to sell the whole thing. They just said to shareholders, so they must just be wanting to sell a minority. But you don't take the main fella and say, can you look after selling this? And you don't instruct the essentially the two biggest banks in the world, really, or certainly two of them, to look after that process if you're not very serious about that. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that they are definitely going to sell it. It certainly doesn't mean that they're going to sell it in a short amount of time, but it definitely means that they are open to it. And that is a significant change from what came before. You know, a hedge fund or an investment vehicle, whatever you want to call it, is always open to a financial offer for one of its assets, because it literally just exists to have capital and increase that capital in whatever sense. So in a different way to what a sole billionaire or a family or a state might do, they would have other reasons to own a massive business, definitely other reasons to own an enormous football club. Theirs is essentially entirely financial. So if it gets to the point where somebody makes them an offer, then that would have always been the case. But this is much more overt still isn't quite the right way, because they haven't said it, but it's much further along, essentially. Yeah. If they're at the point where they're instructing banks and they're putting together, you know, whatever this prospectus looks like, it's just a PowerPoint, maybe, that someone who's really good on PowerPoint makes, I'm not sure.
Not even that good.
But if they're at that point, then that's much further along than just always being open because they're a hedge fund to the possibility of an offer.
I'd like to think we're a slick PDF by now, aren't we?
Google Talk.
I mean, the detail's not necessarily there. The design's excellent. Go on.
Yeah, I think, you know, you don't have to be an economics expert to figure out that they've gone fishing, haven't they? And I think that's where the timeline is the interesting thing in there, with what we've seen happen in the league recently, no Super League, Chelsea being sold, even though with all the chaos going on there, and then the fact that we're going into 6 weeks off now, which effectively gives Mike Gordon 6 weeks in Dubai to get this done.
The fact that obviously Chelsea was sold makes an enormous difference, because there's literally a value put on an extremely similar business, and there are very few similar businesses to an enormous football club. But also there is the start of, I know we're already very much in it, but there is the start of certainly a very significant European recession that will possibly be a global recession. I don't think it's quite sort of settled yet. But certainly sort of in the major Western European economies, there will be one. I'm sure that makes a lot of difference, because if that's where your whole operation is, that's where all of the offices are, that's where all the finance is, all of the money pretty much is done in pounds or euros, then the idea of exchanging that business for one that perhaps operates in dollars a lot more would appeal. There's ideas that like the NBA and the NFL could expand I find it totally believable that if you work for Fenway Sports Group, the idea of having one of those franchises as those leagues expand would not only be really appealing just from your own point of view, you could probably manage it an awful lot easier just because of geography, but also the idea of the prestige and the finance of that would probably far outstrip what any Premier League club could really do. Yes, it is as well. And you're operating, you know, the majority of the time in one currency, so it just makes your whole operation an awful lot easier. And also, whenever we have any conversation about the ownership of Liverpool, whether it's something most of the series like this or just who, you know, will they spend money or whatever, we always talk about them as sort of one entity, but this is loads and loads of different people who have different views on any decision that that whole investment vehicle makes, never mind just things about Liverpool. So probably, which I hadn't really thought about before until this sort of news was announced and I thought about the process, but to have got through 12 years of all of these people being roughly on the same page is probably from their point of view an achievement in and of itself, because these are all people with fingers in different pies financially, you know, different levels of stake in the overall thing. So maybe there's just a point where enough people now are at the point where they're thinking it'd be quite nice if we moved on from that and did this thing instead, because that's worth loads of money. We've done a good job of managing
it. Easy to go to as well. I'm going to fly.
Exactly.
Or I'm going to fly that far.
And I feel like I can be more active in it, whereas, yeah, you know, an awful lot of the people that are shareholders in FSG have been very, very standoffish. You know, there's only really two in John Henry and Tom Werner that we ever hear from.
Oh my God.
And that's increasingly rare as well that you hear from the two main ones. I mean, since
in Werner for donkey's years.
He wrote a letter after Paris, didn't he, to the sports minister, but that was the first time in probably 3 or 4 years he'd made, like, you see him at a Champions League final or something like that from time to time, but an intervention, that was the first time in a long while. So again, I think sort of, yeah, clocking that these are individuals is something that I've sort of only recently done, but I think plays into this whole thing, because this isn't just like one person going, oh, it's time now. This is an awful lot of people with different perspectives on the global economy, and maybe I don't know whether it's over 50% or maybe just enough of them have gone, now is quite a good time, and that's therefore why they've stepped this forward.
The financial world has changed in the last 12 months. And that, for me, you wouldn't bring Redbird in whenever they did bring Redbird in a year ago or so. If you were fully thinking of shifting Liverpool this quickly, the strength of the dollar versus the value of the pound is, for me, absolutely one of the reasons they're going to do that. They know that they can get more value because Liverpool looks cheap at the moment to people with dollars. I've just come back from New York. It felt really, really expensive. And that's not because New York's inexpensive. It's because our currency is shit. And they've kept growing at a regular rate and our currency just hasn't kept up. And that, in really basic terms, tells you why Liverpool is going to feel the reverse.
And at the level of billions.
And that's a huge difference. You know, when you think of a billion as 1,000 million, and you're talking about four of those, or probably, to make those marginal gains on such huge sums, makes it a great time for a dollars or dirhams person to come and buy Liverpool. I would say if you're a British billionaire, I'd be very surprised if you were interested in Liverpool at the moment in this economy. But as Dan said earlier, I think the state of the global economy, and with more likely a European recession than a global one. I'd say that Liverpool looks cheap to some at the moment and good value, but also a great time for FSG to go, well, we can get a little bit more because you know this. So smart people, and just hope they sell it to the right person.
Okay, thank you very much to Paul, to Dan, and to Jake. Keep it out for the Klopp documentary in December coming. It is the absolute business. It will be the absolute business, supported by Erdinger. So thank you very much to them indeed. Thank you very much to Andy and Ash for producing all of this. Enjoy all the Anfield Rap content this week. More from a guttery perspective around the takeover in the next couple of days. That is coming as well. Everything that you want, download the app, do all the bits and pieces. You know what it's all like by now. But also, you get to have a little bit of a break as well. Just sort of power down a little bit. Enjoy the fun stuff in life. Read a book. You never know you're looking at a raffle. Watch some Speedway. Sports Social Podcast Network.
La primavera llegó y eso significa limpieza a tope. Ya sea que necesites comprar cositas de limpieza o cambiar tu ropa de invierno por ropa fresca, asegúrate de usar Ibora para recuperar dinero por cada compra. Ahora mismo, Ibora ofrece a nuestros oyentes $5 solo por descargar usando el código La Música cuando te registras. Simplemente ve al App Store o Google Play Store y descarga la aplicación gratuita de Ibora para empezar a ganar reembolsos. Usa el código La Música. Eso es Ibotta en Google Play o App Store y usa el código La Música.